The next case on our calendar is 05311, State Automobile Mutual Insurance Company versus Oakwood Village Fire Department. Mr. McLandrich.
I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal, if I might. May it please the court, my name's John McLandrich here on behalf of the Village of Oakwood. This case is an appeal that concerns the interaction between sovereign immunity and the public duty doctrine. The case grows out of a fire loss where a suit was brought by the insurer of the landlord. Ohio Briquetting, the third-party plaintiff, was one of the tenants of the building. Oakwood Village was one of 13 fire departments that responded out to this fire. They're from a neighboring jurisdiction, responded out to the fire. We filed a motion to dismiss predicated on sovereign immunity. Trial court denied it. We appealed to the 8th District Court of Appeals. 8th District affirmed the denial, but interestingly found that there were no exceptions to the sovereign immunity that would have applied, which was the premise of our motion, but then found that liability could be imposed on the city through the special duty, special relationship exception to the public duty doctrine.
Mr. McLandrich, let me start you with what I think is a threshold issue. This case was decided on the trial judge's overruling of 12B6 motion, that correct? And which means then the case proceeds. How is that a final appealable order?
Well, we appealed it under the revision to 2744.02 that makes it a final appealable order. And anticipating, I presume, the next question, which is the effective date of the statute, which was April 9th, 2003. And the cases that have construed that that statute and the act itself talk about it applying to causes of action that accrue subsequent to that date. The cause of action that Ohio Briquetting brings is one for contribution and indemnity. That cause of action has yet to accrue. That cause of action accrues when they actually pay, and they've yet to pay. So their cause of action for contribution and indemnity is still yet to accrue, so it is a proper final appealable order.
That apparently wasn't, the Court of Appeals just footnotes this issue, doesn't speak to it at all, so I guess that
the footnote's a little cryptic. It just says they filed a motion and we overruled it without any particular briefing on it, but the other appellate courts that have addressed the issue, and I think this court has one case that sort of addresses the issue, and clearly, the statute applies to causes of action that accrue after April 9th, 03. This cause clearly accrues after April 9th, 03 because it's a claim for contribution and indemnity that will accrue when and if Ohio Briquetting ultimately pays on their underlying claim. But further, even assuming for some reason I was wrong about that, which I don't think that I am, that would mean the Court of Appeals was without jurisdiction, never should have reached the merits, would require this honorable court to vacate their opinion and reverse and remand in any event.
Thank you.
You're welcome. That being said, I think it's very clear that what happened here is the court got the cart before the horse. The special relationship exception to the public duty rule, which, of course, we didn't rely on the public duty doctrine, but they tried to defeat the sovereign immunity motion by relying on the special duty exception, assuming it applied, which, of course, we don't, and that's our first proposition of law. All it does is create a duty, which then establishes one of the elements of a negligence claim, and then, as this court has said, and any number of the appellate courts have said, then you go on and pursue the other elements of your negligence cause of action.
Can I ask a factual question? I just want to make sure I understand, and I know we don't really probably have much of a factual record yet, but right. The special duty seemed to be based on the owner of the building or the owner of the company saying, or somebody from the company saying to the firefighter, you know, there are metals in there, you can't use water.
Yes.
I don't see anywhere in there that the firefighter responded in any way, acknowledged it in any way. It was just a one-sided conversation. By the way, you can't do this because of that. Is that correct?
Well, that's correct on the record that's in front of the court. On the motion to dismiss the allegation, the complaint is that the employee comes out and reminds the chief of the fire department that there are flammable metals in there and that you can't use water to suppress the fire. And so
I guess I'll ask your opponent this. Where then is the assumption of a duty from this? Isn't that more of maybe like a negligence claim that you weren't properly prepared or you weren't properly ready for this type of fire? I had a hard time seeing where a statement from one person to another is the assumption of a special duty. So
I absolutely agree with you, and obviously, we don't think that a special duty was created because of just the reasons that you're saying. What you have is a situation where this employee comes out and warns with respect to the presence of these flammable metals, and then the fire department goes ahead and fights the fire. Certainly, that kind of statement, in our view, is not enough to amount to an affirmative assumption of a duty beyond their statutory duty, because, of course, their statutory duty is to go fight the fire. And when you look at plaintiff's brief, what they really say is, what they're really complaining about is the manner in which the fire was fought. You should have fought it as a Class D fire, which, again, you know, isn't really part of the record, but what that means is you have to snuff it out. You have to take a crane and deliver fluxing salts or sand on top of the flaming metal and snuff out the oxygen source from it and put it out in that fashion.
If this special duty, based on this type of a factual scenario, stands, do we run the danger of anybody saying to a firefighter, I've got this issue or that problem, and that creates the special duty? Is that the danger that we have?
Oh, it absolutely does, because it would be no different than if when you came to the fire, you confront the parent out in the yard and they say, you know, my child's in the upstairs bedroom, and I'll take it a step further. The firefighter says, you know, I'll go up and get him. Well, is he assuming now affirmative duty that he's going to, in fact, be able to rescue the child without the child perishing? He's not. He's just simply doing his statutory duty and saying, yeah, I'll go in there and I'll try and get him. And so in a situation like this, and they say in their brief, well, we're not a member of the general public because we're engaged in this hazardous activity, and you knew we were engaged in this hazardous activity. So when you came out to fight the fire, that was a dedication of a particular resource to a particular person, and so therefore you had a duty to do more than you would do for someone else. You had a duty to come out with the specialized kind of equipment that would be necessary for this fire.
Counsel, does it make a difference that not only did they not fight it according to what the standard tactics would be and use the equipment and the method necessary that I think is agreed upon, but they made it worse?
Well, that's certainly the allegation, yes, ma'am.
Does that make a difference here? You're saying that there was no duty just based on a transference of information. By the way, we've got these specialized flammable metals. You're saying that does not put them on notice that they have to fall back upon their expertise and decide what the most appropriate way is to fight this fire. But not only did they not do that, there's the allegation that the use of water, as opposed to the other method, made it worse.
Well, I think what this goes to is a defense that the trial court never reached and the Court of Appeals never reached, and the Court of Appeals never reached it because it found no exception to the immunity. But if you pursue the immunity analysis long enough, what you get to is the discretionary immunities that are provided in 274403 with respect to decisions, discretionary decision-making about allocation of resources. And so keep in mind, we're the Village of Oakwood in a neighboring jurisdiction. To contend that we should have been able to fight it as a Class D fire would say to us that we should have allocated resources to have a crane sitting in the fire yard in case a Class D fire started either in our jurisdiction or some neighboring jurisdiction, so that then we could, you know, have a dump truck go out there with the fluxing salts or sand and get the crane and deliver it.
And that's all trial material there. I mean, that would all be...
Well, but I think it goes to the point that you're making, which is does the fact that they've put us on some sort of notice, whether by inspection or running out and saying there's Class D materials in there, require us to have the specialized equipment to fight a Class D fire? And what I'm saying is, you know, trial issues aside, that would be immune conduct under 274403 if we pursue the analysis that far, because when we engage in discretionary decision making as to how to allocate our resources in terms of what kind of firefighting equipment to buy, that's not a decision that we get second guessed on.
Right, and I don't think I'm certainly not saying that you should have been poised, ready to fight a fire in a neighboring jurisdiction with, you know, the appropriate resources. I'm not saying that at all.
All right.
But again, the fact that I guess the choice would have been don't do anything, or, you know, use the water, which was
right.
not the correct extinguishing method.
There's no question that, you know, ideally we would have been able to fight it as a Class D fire. But when we arrive there, we have the resources we have, we're presented with the situation that we have. And as we've said in our brief, you know, our duty runs not just to Ohio Briquetting, one tenant of the building, but runs to the landlord and the other tenants of the building. Now, if Ohio Briquetting would have us not use water because it may make their fire worse, let's assume, because that's the allegation of the complaint, and we're required to take that as true, how does that allow us to satisfy our duty to the remaining tenants? And I think that, frankly, if we'd have just said, well, you know, we can't use water because Ohio Briquetting's got flammable material in there, we'd have just been sued, quite frankly, by the other tenants of the building and the landlord for letting their building burn down in its entirety. And again, obviously, these are things outside the record as to how successful the firefighting was or wasn't with respect to containing the fire or not. But certainly that would be the horns of the dilemma that they would be on if they chose to respect the admonition. And of course, the admonition wasn't don't fight it. It was, well, geez, don't put water on it, which, you know, now you've sort of tied our hands because, of course, those are the resources that are available, and that's why it kind of becomes circular and takes us back to 274403 with respect to how we allocate our resources and our ability to fight the fire on any given day. Sort of backing up then, if you will, with respect to the first proposition of law, we certainly don't think that these kinds of statements by a person on the scene of a fire, especially where there's no affirmative expression either by act or orally that we're going to take some action that's in excess of our statutory duty, can amount to a special relationship as an exception to the public duty rule. It just would broaden the exposure for cities beyond comprehension, quite frankly. With respect to the second aspect of the case, from our perspective, it's just very straightforward. Even the appellate court agreed there's no exception to the immunity. The public duty doctrine, I say, it doesn't apply in this case, but even to the extent it could, all it does is establish a duty. Then you'd go through the immunity analysis, which everyone seems to agree, I'm sure the plaintiff won't agree, but seems to agree applies, and there's no exception, and Oakwood Village would be immune. One of our amicus and the plaintiff has picked it up in their brief in opposition, contend that the public duty rule and sovereign immunity can't coexist. That's not the position of the appellant. That may be our amicus position, but from our perspective, the public duty rule and sovereign immunity can and do properly coexist together, and so we're not advocating any abolishment of the public duty rule. We just don't think that it belongs in this case, and certainly, even if someone was to assume arguendo that it does exist in this case, it certainly doesn't exist in a fashion that can trump the immunity that exists under the statute.
Aren't you really asking us to really apply the law the way it's been written and find that the appellate court just made a mistake in the application here?
Absolutely. I mean, that's clearly what they did. And, you know, they just got it backwards. They should have done their duty analysis and then done the immunity analysis, and instead what they did was they did the immunity analysis and then said, well, wait a minute, because there's been some new vitality breathed into public duty doctrine, let's look at this special duty exception. And, you know, that would have sort of been bad enough, but then when they found their special duty, they just stopped dead in their tracks, and then so therefore there can be liability. Well, therefore maybe there can be duty, but to say therefore there can be liability just leaves out an entire level of analysis that they should have then gone into. And so from our perspective, the case clearly needs to be reversed and remanded. I'll just reserve my remaining time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Mr. McLandridge.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Connick.
Thank you, Chief Justice. May it please the Court, my name is Tom Connick. I'm with the law firm of Davis & Young in Cleveland, and I represent Ohio Briquetting. With me at the council table today is Robert Dubiak, my co-counsel. The critical issue here is whether or not the public duty rule and 2744 can coexist. They're saying that it can, we say that it can, but they're saying that there's this interplay between the two. The public duty rule, though, is separate and distinct. It's a common law doctrine. Excuse me. It's a common law doctrine that comport to the general common law principles of negligence. You can't take the duty once it's determined to exist under the public duty rule and then insert it into a statutory scheme. You have to maintain, you have to maintain the analysis under the common law. And Justice Stratton asked the question, well, if wouldn't this public duty arise if somebody went to the fire department and said, well, you know, we have this issue and that issue. The main point of the special duty exception is that there was an increase of risk here. The Oakwood Fire Department did not just say, you know, we're not going to do this or we're not going to do that. My representative from Ohio Briquetting went up to the fire chief and said, look, you've inspected this, you know that these problems exist, don't put fire on this water. And this comes in, here is where the importance of the 12B6 threshold issue comes.
I could go back to that. When the Court of Appeals made it very clear in its opinion that the fact that inspections were made did not create the special duty. It relied solely on your defendant or your party going up to the firefighter and saying, by the way, there's a special problem. Am I correct, or do you disagree that there was nothing said back from the fire chief about what they would do? It was a one-way communication?
I disagree with that, and that's where I was getting to the point where the 12B6 threshold issue is very important here. There's many issues in this case that are not in the record because they're based on the pleadings, and in that you have to take my pleadings and my allegations on behalf of my client as true in all and all reasonable inferences. And what happened, and again, this is not in the record, but Mr. Ischrup from Ohio Briquetting did go up to the fire chief and said, look, you have inspected this area, you've been to these meetings, and this was a multi-aid, by the way, this is important too, this was multi-aid. Oakwood Village was the head of that multi-aid, and he went up to the chief and said, you've been here, you know what's in there, you can't put water on this fire. And the testimony will be by Mr. Ischrup, if we get to that point, again, it's not in the record, that the fire chief said, I'm going to handle this fire the way I see fit, which unfortunately.
Okay, let's assume that that is true then.
Okay.
I'm still struggling with how that creates a special duty, because that type of scenario can rise in hundreds of fires, hundreds of businesses, hundreds of homes with special situations. You know, you have that scenario, and when somebody goes up and says, I have this issue, and the fire chief says, I got to handle it the way I'm going to handle it, why is that not simply an issue of whether they were negligent?
Well,
how does that create a special duty to that person when it's a demand from somebody?
Okay, and that's an excellent question, and the answer is this. There are four elements to creating a special duty under the public duty rule. There is an assumption of an affirmative duty. There is direct contact with the
site. And where is the assumption of an affirmative duty here?
Well, the assumption of the affirmative duty here is that by not putting water on the fire, when the state, local, and national fire codes say that these Class D fires cannot be fought this way, and
that's an assumption. That's a refusal to do something. That's not an assumption.
The assumption comes from the fact that the Oakwood fire chief increased the harm to Ohio Briquetting, knowingly increased the harm to them, and then after he increased the harm to them by putting the water on the fire, was negligent. And even doing that part.
Okay, but that's a whole lot of other things, but that's not an assumption of a duty. Assumption of duty is I'm going to do this to take care of you. I'm going to take this step to do something special for you.
Not under the special relationship exemption. Under the special relationship, the first prong is an affirmative duty could be taken by affirmation, by some verbal conduct, or by actions. And our position is the action taken by Oakwood created that special
But the general duty rule is that the fire department owes the same duty to everyone.
Correct.
In order for a special duty to arise, as Justice Stratton was pointing out, there has to be going beyond, there has to be some special relationship that doesn't exist to everyone.
That's correct.
And the mere fact that they said you shouldn't put water on this fire really does not create a special duty.
What I think the 8th District said, and which I think was accurate, especially again going under the 12B6 analysis, which all reasonable inferences have to be favorable to my client, is we went up to the fire chief at the scene of the crime. Now the inspections, and I understand this, and it's been held by this court and other courts, the inspections standing alone do not create the special duty, but taken together, the fact that Oakwood did have those inspections done, they were in that building, they knew that there were over 100,000 pounds of Class D flammable materials in there, they knew or should have known that putting water suppression media on those types of items would cause catastrophic purposes. Taking all of that together without a vacuum creates that affirmative duty.
That's all negligence issues. Those are all just negligence issues. I don't see anyone taking an affirmative promise to do something in that whole scenario, even assuming every fact you say is true.
Well,
so I guess I'm struggling with how you legally meet the test. You may have a great negligence claim, but where do you legally meet this? your first prong is taking an affirmative duty, and you can't even make the first prong, as far as I can see.
The first prong, our position is, the first prong is created with the reasonable inferences that are drawn from our 12B6, or from the motion to dismiss. We get those inferences. Again, it's not in the record, but my representative is going to say that Chief Magi looked at him and said, I'm going to handle this fire the way I see fit.
But
the
that's not in your complaint. Chief, that wasn't in your complaint, even alleged. You didn't have that specific response.
No, a specific response complaint. Wasn't, but we get those reasonable inferences. And again, there's a lot of facts in this case that are not in the record because they can't be at this stage of the proceedings.
Now, if the chief would have said, I'm going to handle the fire exactly the way you tell me to handle it, that would be the creation of a special duty, special relationship. But the fact that he said, I'm going to handle it the way I see fit.
Well, I think what the Eighth District Court was doing, in which I agree with, is they were taking all these facts, and not in a vacuum, but they were taking them together to create the affirmative duty by the actions, not a verbal response by the fire chief, but by his actions. And it's our position that making the decision in the known of a, in the face of a known danger, Chief Magi, as he was the head of this multi-aid task force that was responding to this fire, he knew or should have known as the chief that by putting water media on this, bad things are going to happen. I think everybody in this courtroom, by the time they were in seventh grade, figured out you don't put water on magnesium because bad things are going to happen. When he made that decision, knowing that he was going to increase the danger to property damage and or life, and chose to go ahead anyways, despite the fact that there was this express warning, that creates a duty because Ohio River County had no recourse at that point in time. They couldn't
have
done
anything. Were there, in fact, other tenants in that building and other tenants that did not have magnesium and those materials?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear that.
Were there, in fact, other tenants that did not have the metals in that building?
Yes.
And what was the duty to those other tenants?
And that was something raised by Mr. McClendrick. My position on behalf of Ohio River County has been, and again, this goes into what would ultimately be expert testimony in the underlying case, which is not in the record, but my position is they should have done nothing and contained the outer barrier, and they could contain the outer barrier with water and not affect the guts of my client's warehouse. The evidence, again, not in a record, but there's evidence in this case. When the water went on the building, that's when the explosions occurred. That's when they exacerbated the damage. And Chief Magi knew when he put the water on that fire that that was going to happen. And the affirmative duty comes from the action of doing that, knowing that he was going to increase that risk of harm, and in the face of that increased risk of harm, doing it negligently. So our position is the public duty rule does coexist with 2744. In fact, 2744, in my reading of the statute, even invites the use of the public duty rule and, by extension, the exception. In 2744.03A7, it allows sovereigns to benefit from all defenses at common law, which the public duty rule is. It's a common law doctrine. It's been in existence since the king's days. So it's our position that it does coexist, but it coexists in, if you can envision, two railroad tracks, okay? 2744 does not create or provide for any type of special duties. They provide five singular exceptions. The public duty rule, which quite frankly is more of a harsh rule than 2744 as far as sovereign immunity goes, does create that special duty. And it's our position that that special relationship exception would allow public entities and public individuals, when that duty is to be determined to arise, to protect them from the more harsh situations, the more grossly negligent, the more recklessness types of situations as occurred in this case, allow them recovery. As a public policy of this state, I don't think that a sovereign should be protected from such egregious activity that occurred in this case. Chief Magi, and I keep going back to this point because this is critical, and in response to Justice Stratton and Justice Resnick, it does answer the affirmative duty question. Knowingly increasing the risk of harm and going forward in the face of that risk of harm, knowing that what is in that building and in the face of, look, don't do this. I mean, Chief Magi was faced with a big stop sign. Don't do this, and he does it anyway. That was an affirmative duty, especially, back to my other point, especially when Ohio Briquetting had absolutely no recourse. Ohio Briquetting, all they could do was stand there, literally stand there, and watch as Chief Magi puts the improper media on this fire and literally watches this business explode, literally. And they had no recourse. When you don't have any recourse, coupled with the fact that Chief Magi is flying in the face of acceptable codes, standards, and everything else, and knowingly increasing the harm, that is an expression of an affirmative duty. Because basically what is happening, that's an act. Basically what Chief Magi is doing is saying, look, I'm going to do this. I know it's wrong, or at least I should know it's wrong, but I'm going to do it, and I'm going to make it right. Now, did he necessarily say that? No, I can't say that he did. But his actions certainly rise to that level. And at the very least, we should be allowed to go back and present evidence on that issue.
Let me give you an opportunity. I'm still troubled by the final appealable order here, even though Justice Douglas is gone. He used to be the champion of final appealable orders. Sure. Someone has to pick up the cudgel, I guess. But 2744.02, it's in its most current version, C, says an order that denies a political subdivision the benefit of an alleged immunity from liabilities provided in this chapter or any other provision of the law is a final order. Here, the trial court decided that 12B6 motion should be overruled because the trial court wasn't convinced that the case should be dismissed. Does that the case then proceeds? It doesn't seem to me that Oakwood was denied the benefit of an alleged immunity from liability. That issue is still an open issue.
I agree, Your Honor. And I filed a motion with the appellate court asking for a dismissal of the appeal.
And their discussion of it is nil.
No.
I mean, it doesn't help us at all,
no.
Except for a footnote that says that in another case they said it was prospective, which I don't quite see how that helps in this case.
I agree. And I would agree with you that it should go back to the trial court. And I'm going to ask this court that it remand this matter back to the trial court for further proceedings consistent with the trial court's decision denying Oakwood's motion to dismiss, so we could put these matters to the evidence. I don't know why the appellate court did what it did. I felt, as you did, Mr. Chief Justice, that it was not a final appealable order, other than the revision to 2744, as Mr. McClendrick indicated, but that's all the appellate court gave us, and it wasn't addressed further. But I would agree with you that based on that, that would leave this court with grounds to remand it back to the trial court. And I see my time is running short, and I would just ask that this court affirm the 8th District Court of Appeals and determine that the public duty rule, and specifically the special relationship exception to the public duty rule, can coexist with 2744. It is applicable to this case, and under the 12B6 procedural status in this case, that this court remand this matter back to the trial court for further proceedings, including prosecution of Ohio Briquetting's case against the City of Oakwood. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Koenig. Mr. Landrick, you've saved 2 minutes of your time, and I should start you. You probably want to respond to my picking up on the final appeal order.
Absolutely, and I have a point in that regard.
General language, which doesn't seem to me that this, it sure doesn't fit. I mean, overruling a 12B6 sure does not fit all of our law and what is the final appeal order. It doesn't dispose of the case.
Well, and obviously we have a new statutory provision that we haven't had before. My problem with the position that is being suggested is, if that's correct, then immunity is never denied until the case is tried. Because, of course, you can say the same thing about the summary judgment motion. You know, there's no question of fact here. Now it's just a question of law whether immunity applies to this claim on these allegations. Now, if we're wrong, is immunity, you're saying immunity wasn't really denied to them because they can raise it later. Well, of course, and then we file the motion for summary judgment, raise immunity again. If it's overruled, well, you're really not denied because you can raise it again at
that's
trial.
Right. And that's not final appeal because the case isn't disposed of. The case, the court's just simply saying you're going to go ahead and try it.
And if that's the case, though, then that provision 2744.02c has absolutely no meaning because after the case is tried, it's always a final appealable order. So we never needed to put that provision in the code to begin with.
This case is a pretty good example, it seems to me, of why we've said what we've said in all of our case law, that you need to get the record complete. Here we're struggling with with pleadings, and as some of the questions indicate, it would have been helpful to have had a full record. You might argue with that. It's a legal question also. So,
well, it's a little bit unfortunate, though, to penalize the defendant for the adequacy of the complaint that the plaintiff pled. And because otherwise, as I say, there's no point to 2744.02c, and I understand the court's, you know, feeling that, well, these cases should just come up after they're tried, but of course the legislature's made that determination, and so either we're going to make 2744.02c a dead letter, or it's going to have some meaning, because it's always a final appealable order once the case has been tried. And unfortunately, though, then what we've done is, you know, it's a little bit of the horns of the dilemma. Otherwise, then we've defended the whole case, we've been through trial, to come back and find that we never should have been in the case to begin with because we were immune from the outset. So there's, you know, there's a certain tension between the efficiencies of not coming too soon and not going through the whole proceeding just to come back and find that we never should have gone through the proceeding.
But that's an argument that could be made on every motion that's not dispositive of a case. We've heard that argument.
And
you're right, it would be more efficient, perhaps, to resolve these sort of interlocutory issues before the case is decided, but that's not our law generally.
Well, it's not our law generally, but of course now the legislature has created this special arrangement with respect to the political subdivisions, which I don't know, frankly, how has any meaning if we don't do it at the 12b6 stage or we don't do it at the summary judgment stage. If we're only going to do it after trial, then I don't know what 2744.02c means. That being said, if I could address a couple of other things very briefly. Plaintiff asked the court to affirm. Obviously, they don't feel there was any jurisdiction, so they really can't ask the court to affirm. The opinion would have to get vacated, and the matter would go back to the trial court, assuming it wasn't a final appealable order. That aside, the special duty doctrine doesn't create a cause of action. All it does is create a duty that then you can pursue like any other cause of action, whether it's valid or not. The inspection, he talks about the inspection, then he talks about this comment by Mr. Eiskrupp. The comment by Mr. Eiskrupp provides no more information than they already had from the inspections. If the inspections themselves were insufficient to create a special duty, how does coming out and remind me what I already know through the inspections change that equation? Further, what duty did we accept beyond our statutory duty of fighting the fire? Our duty was to fight the fire. That was the same thing we did after the admonition. There's no new duty that's created. You know, his description of what created the duty, this knowingly increasing the risk of harm and disregarding that risk of harm, sounds to me like a lot like the legal definition of recklessness. You go look at this court's cases on the definition of recklessness, and that's the description of it. All that means is, well, geez, I think they were really negligent. So based on that,
maybe it's the term fight the fire.
Well, I mean, fight the fire is our statutory duty.
You don't
duty.
Fight fire by squirting gasoline on it, and you don't fight this fire, apparently, by squirting water on it.
And, you know,
So you really didn't fight the fire.
Well, now, I guess we can certainly take these examples
and
as far as we like.
Isn't that what it comes down to?
Well, if it was an oil well fire, perhaps pouring gasoline on it would be the appropriate thing to do. You know, an oil well fire, they take the dynamite out there and they dynamite it. And so now we're talking about their discretion and their decision-making as to how to fight the fire. Certainly they may have got it wrong in a given case, but isn't that what negligence and breach of duty cases are about? They're not about creating duty. They're about saying you breached your duty. And that's what their case is about. And so certainly we would ask the court to reverse and enter judgment for Oakwood.
Thank you. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.